Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Before Frank Gore got injured, he was the best I had ever seen till this day. And when I saw him drop back in coverage and get that interception, I was honestly in shock. It felt like my body went numb. I always liked Eli's quarterback, but he made me a fan that day. I was like, that's a bad white boy.
Yo, welcome to All Things Covered with Patrick Peterson and Bryant McFadden, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. The name says it all. If you like what you hear, make sure you leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube. Just visit youtube.com/allthingscovered. So make sure you're subscribed and turn on your alerts so you can get the show right away. Pat P, what are we going to cover on this episode?
Yo, Mac, man, the Vike fans been loving our Skull Check-In.
Yes, sir.
So we got to give them a little sneak peek on the minicamp, on our minicamp expectations.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to check with a South Florida great and a Super Bowl champ, Antre Roll. He went to the U, Mac, since you ain't going to say it.
I'm not going to say that.
He went to the U. I ain't going to put up a symbol, but he went to the U.
Stay tuned. Ladies and gents, first quarter of our show, you know what we do. We chop it up. And during this chopping it up segment, this is a very, very special, special week. Juneteenth is later this week. So we're not going to highlight anything football related. We're just going to highlight social life related, relatable things. And for us being African Americans, this is a very, very special, special date. Juneteenth is also called Freedom Day, Jubilee Day, Emancipation Day. Juneteenth is a holiday celebrated on June 19th to commemorate the emancipation of enslaved people in the U.S. The holiday was celebrated in Texas in 1865. The Emancipation Proclamation happened in 1862, but the official celebrating year was 1865, June 19th. And because Juneteenth is happening later this week, we like to kind of highlight some of the things the NFL has been doing. So you look at some of the steps the league has made over the past year or so to promote not just Juneteenth, but social justice. They've donated a lot of money. This time last year, the NFL committed $250 million over a 10-year span to combat systematic racism. They've also done a great job in recognizing June 19th as an official holiday. All offices associated with the National Football League will be closed. So that's a great, great sight to see. And I think they will continue to do other things as well. The NFL and the Senior Bowl, they will host an HBCU Combine starting this upcoming season to highlight some of the outstanding football players that are playing in HBCU programs so they can get a fair opportunity to showcase their talent and their skill set to be able to be drafted. So hearing these things and knowing what Juneteenth means to all of us, to say the least, especially African-Americans, you know, how does that make you feel? What are your feelings knowing the NFL, they're doing more than just, you know, donating money to really support the cause and make things a little fair when it comes to, you know, individuals not having the same platform as some other guys?
You know, I think it's a start. You know, I think they're definitely moving in the right direction as far as bringing more awareness to social injustice, the whole reasoning behind June 19th.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I feel like we still got a ways to go. You know, it's a start, you know, in the right direction. But, you know, I want to see more coaches have more opportunities. You
no
know,
questions.
I want not just, you know, having you know, African-American coaches at just a position. I want to see what those guys have more power than what they have. You know what I mean? So really make it feel like it's freedom. You know what I mean? Because it's still a bunch of, you know, African-American coaches that feel like, you know, they're handcuffed. So
mm-hmm.
I think they still need to do a better opportunity of honoring the Rooney Rule, of making sure that more people of color not just, you know, just not African Americans, but other minorities in general have the same opportunity that, you know, whites have. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's what's really going to start to get this thing in the right direction, because we see it every year to where we have a number of black coaches on that you know, that coaching panel that, you know, that's for coaching vacancies. And 9 times out of 10, I feel like they don't really get a fair shot. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, with them stepping up to the plate and, you know, committing $250 million over the next 10 years is just a great start. But I feel like, you know, it's so much more I feel that needs to be done, you know, to in order for us to feel like we're on the same playing field, so we can feel equal, so we can actually feel like we're free. Because, you know, just what, not too long ago, you know, we had opportunities to really break the barrier of having African-American coaches hired, but we dropped the ball again. You know what I mean? I don't know what it is or what's causing organizations to not give these coaches of colors or coaches of minority an opportunity to lead a football team. But I think the league is definitely doing a great job of getting a ball rolling. And it's definitely exciting to see. I'm excited to see Eddie George, the Deons of the world, getting into those HBCU avenues to where, you know, now we can, you know, have an opportunity to get our youth, our community on a higher level, because we know HBCUs don't get many looks, but it's a lot of talent that come out of HBCUs.
Yes, sir.
So I think now having the HBCU combine will just open the door for a lot more coaches, because, you know, a lot of great coaches are in the HBCU. A lot of great black coaches are in the HBCU, but they don't have the opportunity to showcase what they have. But I think now having a combine for those guys, being able to, you know, have those kids showcase their talent coming from those HBCUs, I believe now it's going to open the eyes of, like, now seeing, like, oh, black coaches can really coach players. You know, and they can really run an organization. They can really get guys to where they need to be. They can motivate guys. You know, I feel like everybody on this earth is on the same playing field. We just don't have the same opportunities.
Yep. And also, too, you look at your new home team, the Minnesota Vikings. Minnesota has been a vocal point, you know, of the social justice movement. I mean, the owners of the Vikings have pledged to try and make a positive change. So that's a plus to see the organization, you know, trying to step forward and doing better things to make it a fair playing field, to say the least. And one thing I would like to see the NFL do is do a better job in educating and bringing more light to iconic individuals that, you know, are African Americans. Like when you look at Major League Baseball, you know, they have Jackie Robinson Day, right? Mm-hmm. That happens every year. Pat P, have you ever heard of Kenny Washington?
No, I haven't.
See, that's the thing. I didn't either until I had to do some research, right? Kenny Washington, for our listeners and our viewers that are tuning in to us, All Things Covered, Pat P, Brian McFadden, Kenny Washington was the first black player to play in the modern NFL. Went to UCLA, played halfback, set a college record, a then college record for having over 3,200 yards of total offense. Was an All-American in 1940. He also played baseball at UCLA with Jackie Robinson. They played together. But because the NFL had banned black players, when he graduated from UCLA, he wasn't able to play because they did not allow black players to play in the league. Mm-hmm. So he became a LA cop. He became a teacher. He played in minor leagues for a few years. And then eventually, when the Second World War ended, they forced the NFL to change their policies. So at that time, the Rams were located in Cleveland. So they relocated to LA. And for them to avoid losing their lease at the LA Memorial Coliseum, the league mandated that they draft a black player. And that said player that they drafted was Kenny Washington, also known as the Kingfish. That was his nickname. A heck of a nickname, by the way. He only played a few years with the Rams. Yeah, he only played a few years with the Rams because his knees were so beat up for playing in the minor league that he did. But he was the first black player to play in the modern NFL era. Kenny Washington. He died in 1971 at the age of 52. But like, you didn't know who he was. I didn't know who he was. That's something that I wish the NFL would do more of, educating, you know, showing, giving their, giving guys like Kenny Washington his flowers, even though he's not here. I'm pretty sure his family would love to hear his name be highlighted and echoed throughout the National Football League, throughout the world.
Because like, you never hear about, like, I never knew, obviously to the day, who was the first NFL black player.
Yeah, in the modern NFL.
In the modern era. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think, you know, Kenny definitely deserves a day because, you know, he opened the door for all of us who playing the game today.
Yeah, and think about this. So he broke down the color barrier in the NFL in 1946. Right. And a year later, his college baseball teammate, Jackie Robinson, broke down the baseball color barrier in Major League. So right. Kenny Washington just wasn't a difference maker in football, but he also was a difference maker in sports because he was the first, and then Jackie Robinson followed him a year later in 1947.
Yep.
That's huge.
That's big. I love it.
No doubt. No doubt. Now it's time for Skoll Check-In. But before we get into Skoll Check-In, make sure you stay with us on the opposite side of the half. Antrell Rose, Super Bowl champion, college All-American, will be joining us on the opposite side of the half. But now let's attack the Vikings side of things. Skoll Check-In. Pat P, this is a very, very important week for Minnesota, for the Vikings, for the organization. Minicamp will start. Minicamp expectations is this Skoll Check-In topic. For Pat P, you've been in the league for quite some time, but break down the difference between minicamps and OTAs.
Honestly, Mac, there's no real big difference. I think minicamp is more getting guys geared up for how an in-season practice will go or how training camp is going to be. I think it's just, you know, OTAs is just getting us prepared, obviously going through all the plays, make sure everybody know their checks, everybody know where they need to be. And minicamp is just like a ramp up from that. And then obviously mm-hmm. training camp is training camp. So, you know, my expectations throughout this mini camp that's going to happen this week is we had a great OTAs, great team chemistry. Now we're just going out there and just getting used to training camp, like what practice is going to be like, you know, mm-hmm. because we've been practicing.
Because mini camp, you have two practices a day, right?
I think it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think it's 3 days.
But it's two. Is it two practices a day or just one?
It's just one, but meetings are a little bit longer. So you'll meet in the morning, do your workout, go practice. Then you gotta come back and, you know, clean up the film that you put on tape in that morning practice. You know, get all the kinks out, and then the next day you do it all over again. So it's just like a shorter version of the in-season practice versus OTAs is just like you're out there for an hour and a half, mm-hmm. get your workout in, and you back at the house.
Gotcha.
You know, versus you get out of the building around 1 o'clock doing OTAs, you know, versus minicamp, you get out of the building around 3:30, you know, so yeah. It's just about a 2 hour longer period. But, you know, we've been looking really, really good. You know, a lot of guys all the guys have been here for the most part. And, you know, guys,
that's a great sign.
Guys have it on their mind to where, you know, we have to get together to understand one another, to make sure that we can trust one another when we're out there on the field, to where, you know, the chips and the dominoes going to fall where they need, you know.
Yeah.
So minicamp, OTAs, well, OTAs have been great. I'm looking for a great minicamp as well.
Hey, and I know you spoke about, you know, I asked you a few weeks ago when you guys first got involved in OTAs, players that stuck out to you. You highlighted Dalvin Cook. No surprise there. Yeah. But, you know, upon finishing OTAs and now getting ready for minicamp, is there another player that kind of have stuck out to you? Like, yo, I mean, this guy could really be a big asset for what we're trying to do during the season. Is there another guy that have caught your eye?
Yeah, it's a couple guys, man. Xavier Woods.
Safety.
Which, yep. Yeah, been really good with this, man. Just a seasonal vet, you know, always going to be where he needs to be. Going to make the right checks, going to make the right calls. You know, just a smooth criminal, you know. Mm-hmm. He don't know this yet, but I call him Daddy Smooth, man, because he don't say any words, but when he out there, he's always where he needs to be. And my second player, this is no surprise, you know, watching from afar for so many years and being able to grow up with him was Justin. You know, I think I told Harrison this maybe like 3 days ago. I was like, man, that Justin, he get it, man. And I think we talked about it, mm-hmm. you know, not before I was even his teammate when we had him on the episode. You know, you could just tell he's one of those guys that get it, comes into work. He's a pro. I mean, very efficient in practice. Just a guy that seems like he's been in the league for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's very rare that you can see a second year, that you can look at a second year player and be like, damn, he's been here before, but he really hasn't. And then that's just a credit to his family, obviously the way he go about his business and what he wants his career to be. You know what I mean? You can tell he wants to be special. He loves the game.
Big things.
And he loved coming to work every day. I tell you this, in minicamp, this one I knew Justin wanted to get good. So our last day of OTAs I think it was Thursday, Justin didn't want to go at no other corner but me.
Really?
That's my first time I ever got called out. I'm on the bench. Right, I just got a rep done. We had just won a rep, maybe three or two reps. Me and him went, and we were just doing releases.
Yeah.
He put his helmet on and said, yo, Pat, I need you. I said, all right, okay.
Okay, yeah.
And I strapped up, you know, and I gave him the look that, you know, that he want because, you know, he wants to get better. And just seeing that, hearing that, being around him every day is a pleasure because I've seen that when he was a kid. Like we talked about before, like I've seen him since he was 11, 12 years old, and he always had that about him. Mm-hmm. And not to be his teammate.
Yo.
Justin, the real deal.
You got to love that. We re-released the Justin Jefferson episode last week, and we asked viewers to comment how many touchdowns they think Jefferson will have in 2021. Everyone said over 10.
Yeah, I'm going to say 10 plus.
At 7 last year, you're saying at least 10.
10 plus.
No doubt. I think that's a doable number.
Yeah,
10 plus. A doable number. And I can tell you this much. If he continues to go in the direction we believe he will go in, he can easily jump into that top 10 wide receiver conversation.
Hey, Matt, go back. You remember when we was talking about releases and running routes, right?
Yep.
With Justin.
Yep.
Dog, he ran a route on me, right? So I had to ask him, like, what was that route? Like tell me, like, what was that? It wasn't a red zone. But he sold it so well to where I didn't know what route it was. It was just like a Dino, but he sold the out so well to where, you know, because it was in the red zone. I think it was like plus 15, maybe. He had a cut mm-hmm. split. And, you know, most of the time when receivers run like that angle out,
yeah,
they're trying to get on a cut split. They're trying to get back to the DB's outside shoulder because that's where the most room the quarterback can throw the ball.
Mm-hmm.
We was in I can't remember what coverage we was in, but I had a middle field safety.
So you had a safety inside of you?
Yes, I had a safety inside of me at the 15-yard mm-hmm. line. And he sold the out so well. I still was in position, but he sold the out so well and it was with his feet. It wasn't even with his eyes. You know, most receivers, you know, look this way.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, throw off the what's name. But he sold it so well to where when he came to me, when the red zone, obviously we know we got to be slow because we're protecting the goal line.
No question.
But he ran up to me on like on a little bit of a stem outside to the bottom of the numbers. And he did me. He almost hit like a Euro step. It literally was like a Euro step, man. I kid you not. He went in and went out for a hard two steps and came back in? Yes. So after practice, I was like, yo, Jay.
So it's basically he had a cut split, which is a tight split. Outside release to your outside shoulder, yes. Like he's gonna run an out or a fade ball, hit you with an in, hit you with an out, and then hit you right back with an in. So it was like a skin, it was like a quick, it was a skinny.
Yeah, man, it was a Dino. They call it a Dino.
Dino. Yeah. Corner, yeah. Post. It's that post corner post.
Yes.
That's exactly. What it is. That post corner so post.
It was like I was like, man, you really got me. Like he didn't give me because I was under the route and I had safety inside, but I was so ready to break on that out route to where it was like, damn, like the way he gave me like three moves in one.
Let me understand this. So basically, because like you said, most wide receivers, they either give you the head, the head placement to look, to kind of get you off your leverage, or they get you with the shoulders. He literally got you with his legs.
Man, it was like, I kid you not, Mac. It was like the Euro.
But he has it's an unorthodox style right. of running routes. And remember, I mentioned that to him when he was on the show. When you watch him run routes, he runs routes that they're not usually a coaching method for other wide receivers.
Right.
He run routes the only way that he can run routes. He's the only man that can run routes how he runs routes because it's not an orthodox style.
Right.
He has a lot of Stevie Johnson in him.
I was just about to say that. Stevie Johnson, Keenan Allen,
Justin Jefferson. Yeah.
League of their own when it comes to, like, they really brought basketball to the football field.
No question.
Kid you not. No.
Yeah. All his routes looks like he's dribbling a basketball.
Right.
And you just mentioned it. Yeah. Keenan Allen is almost like Justin Jefferson is a mixture of Keenan Allen and Stevie Johnson with his route running ability. Perfect. And what you just said, he hit you with that in, out, in, and didn't utilize his head or his shoulders, utilized right. his legs.
And another crazy thing, if I didn't break stride, Mac.
Oh, it was in stride.
In stride.
Oh, so you got to react fast. And if the ball is placed where it's supposed to play, be placed at correctly, mm-hmm. it's a touchdown.
Yep.
Unless you guess correctly. That's the thing. If you guess, you better be right.
Got to be right.
And just hope that's not a perfect pass. Man, that's unique right there. But, yeah, he has an unorthodox style of running routes that he only could execute. And he's been executing it for a long, long time. And that's why he's so successful. And that's why he's so hard to cover. Because he's running routes in a way that we're not used to seeing.
Right.
Yep. You know what I'm saying? It's not like we're not used to seeing like bang bang type routes. It's almost like he's setting you up to cross you over. And right. he does. And you know who also has that little crossover game also? Davante Adams.
Yes.
He has a little bit of that in him as well. The basketball to the football field.
But he's more like in the red zone. Like he's more like he get more crafty in the red zone because he understand that DBs are playing with leverage and we're using the sideline and other things for protection. So he does a great job in the red zone of selling that fade route. Coming back down to the front pylon. He do a great job of, you know, selling that slant and coming back down to the pylon. Like Aaron Rodgers, one of the greatest back shoulder throwers, probably one of the best placement throwers that I've ever been around. So
yeah,
it's better for him in the red zone. But far as when he's in the field, he's a little bit more, you know, traditional. But in that red zone, that's when he get a little crafty.
No question. That's good. And speaking of Justin Jefferson, last thing before we transition to Has Pat Heard, we're currently in Skoll check-in, getting some updates with the current Minnesota Vikings. Kirk Cousins says he will be an open book for Kellen Mond, which is great to hear. Also, another great thing to hear is the Vikings inform Kirk Cousins that they would take a quarterback at some point in time in the draft. Mm-hmm. So Kirk Cousins got the notification that Aaron Rodgers didn't get 2 years ago. You would think if you were that said organization franchise quarterback, they would let you know at some point in time, we're probably going to try to take a quarterback if that guy's available. Kirk right. Cousins received that information. Aaron Rodgers did not. Green Bay Packers, you should have took a snippet out of the Vikings book on how to treat your quarterbacks if you're happy with them. But he said he will be an open book for Kellen Mond. I'm sorry, second round draft pick from Texas A&M. What have you seen from Kirk Cousins with his play and his leadership? And what are your early impressions of Kellen Mond?
You know, Kirk has been great. Captain Kirk has been Captain Kirk. Yeah, he's been sharp, you know, putting the ball where he needs to be. And Kirk has a great cast around him. Just to have, you know, two receivers, a tight end and a running back, and now get, you know, beefing up the offensive line this year and having one of his best completion ratings in the season last year. Mm-hmm. I think the sky's the limit for him. You know, now we just got to go out there and continue building on, you know, what they started last year. You know, making sure that you put the balls in the right in the right player's hands. Like we talked about earlier with Antrell, converting on third downs, you know, not turning the ball over. And that's the biggest thing about NFL quarterbacks. You know, obviously you need defense to play well, you know, whenever the quarterback's not on. But that's the greatest thing about Tom Brady, man. You know, he understands what he means to the football team. He understands what his play means to the outcome of the football game as well. In order to give your team the best position, the best opportunity to win football games is limiting turnovers, convert on third down. And if you're able to do that and have a solid defense that's able to get on, you know, make a couple stops on third down, obviously not letting teams score in the red zone. That's a good recipe for success. You know, mm-hmm. It's just going to come down to us as a defense of not letting teams score, and to Kurt, you know, managing the offense in the way that he did last year. You know, not putting us in bad positions, making sure that, you know, we always have a chance.
Yeah. And Kellen Munn, I'm sorry, I misspoke. He was a third-round selection, not second-round, third-round selection.
Kellen have an opportunity to not really see what he has, because he's been getting a little bit of time with the twos and the threes. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time when we're on the sideline, we're kind of correcting ourselves, you know.
You're not really watching.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, early on seeing him, I think it was last week where he got a little bit more burn. You could definitely tell that the game is coming to him. You know, the game is, and we know as rookies, you know, everything is moving so fast, especially, you know, when all the vets come around and those days start to kind of blend in together. But you could tell he's going to be a good one. And you saw that same process when he was at Texas A&M with a Florida State, ex-Florida State head coach Jimbo.
Jimbo, yep.
You know, you can tell that he have great quarterback mannerism. He's just going to come. Mm-hmm. It's just going to come down to him understanding the scheme, learning the scheme, and understanding, like we talked about, you know, what, you know, how important he is to the team, you know, because most losing teams, they're always at the top in freaking turnovers.
Yep.
They can't convert on third downs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just going to come down to those two point of emphasis throughout the season to see if we can, you know, be what we want to be. And obviously for Collins, Kellen's future, you know, that we'll see what happens.
Okay. There you have it. Skol check in. Big time week for the Minnesota Vikings. Mini camp is coming up. Now it's for your favorite part of the show. Has Pat heard? Man, we got some good questions for Pat P today. I think we got him. His record so far, out of 59 questions, he's gotten 40 right, currently 68%. That's pretty good. Pretty good number. Last week, 5 questions, he got 3 right. 3 out of 5 last week. Pretty good. Pretty good. This week, I don't know if he's going to be in the pluses this week. First question for you. Fullback, Danny Vitale.
Oh, I got
who played for the Packers, the Patriots, and the Browns. He announced his retirement on what website?
Yeah, I got this wrong already, Mac. I don't know.
LinkedIn. He did it on LinkedIn. So what he did was he announced that he was retiring.
You talking about the little friend thing on email?
Yeah, yeah. The little like it's like the job, you know, site. Yeah, he posted on LinkedIn. So what he did was he kind of, you know, put up who he was. He graduated from Northwestern University with a degree in economics. He also earned a minor in business institutions, integrated marketing communications. He's passionate about anything he sets his mind to. He's goal-driven, hardworking, and looking to improve on every aspect of his life every single day. So what he did was he just kind of made it known that he was retiring, but he also added basically a part of who he is to kind of create another opportunity for him. Mm-hmm. Hashtag open to work. So a kind of smart way in trying to create another avenue, you know, when you retire from one career, trying to get another career started. But yes, he posts his retirement on LinkedIn. I think that's the first. So you got that one wrong.
I got that wrong.
Yeah. And speaking of retiring, let's use this opportunity to talk about a current legend, a legend you played with, a legend I played with, whose announcement we've been waiting for quite some time on whether he will retire or come back. And that's Larry Fitzgerald. What do you think Larry Fitz will do?
Hey, if he ain't retired yet, he ain't gonna retire.
Ooh. Ooh. But the thing though is, Pat, this is the conundrum that I think will be surrounding Larry Fitz. Will they have room for him in AZ? Because you got D-Hop, you got Christian Kirk, you got AJ Green. You drafted, remember, friend of the show, Rondell Moore. I think Rondell went in the second round,
listen,
if I'm not mistaken. You got Danny Isabella still. They got
Andy Isabella didn't even play
Andy Isabella.
Yeah, Andy didn't even play last year.
But you used a second rounder on Rondell Moore.
Yeah.
And you know you use a second rounder on a guy, he's not sitting down. He's going to play at some point in time.
You never know up over there. You never know.
Okay. Well, with AJ Green, if he's healthy, you know, he's going to be in the lineup. So it's like where it's almost like they made so many moves anticipating Larry Fitz walking away because they went and added a high round draft pick at the wide receiver position and brought in a seasoned vet who is, when he is healthy, he still can be a productive player. So
I think they'll definitely find a way. They will find a way for if Larry wanted to come back, you know, late in the year or whenever, you know, whenever the time may permit itself, they'll find a way.
What about this though, Pat P? Let's say Larry wants to play Arizona. Like, you know, you said sometimes is Arizona. You never know. Got to expect the unexpected. Have you heard any Viking buzz associated with Larry Fitzgerald?
No.
You know, he used to be a ball boy there.
Yeah, I know.
From Minnesota.
I haven't. You know, that'd be interesting, to, you know, if he would want to come back to Minnesota. But now I necessarily don't see that happening. If it was a team that he was going back to, it'd be Arizona. Larry.
And if you're saying either he plays with Arizona or he don't play.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or I could see him going to Tampa too. One of the two teams. Yeah.
They definitely don't have no room for him.
But listen, at the end of the day, what Larry wants is a championship. Period. And I, you know, if that's because if you look at his, you know, last year, I think he played, he missed a couple games. You know, I think obviously it was one of his lowest, you know, play counts in his career.
Yeah.
But Larry understands the position that he's in right now. He's not going to go out there and give you 40, 50 plays a game. He'll be in year 17. He understands he could probably go out there and give you a good 20 at least. And, you know, why not it be with a system that you already know and Bruce Arians or mm-hmm. come back to Arizona to help if they able to make the run, help those guys make a push in the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, we got to wait and see. He played in 66% of the offensive snaps for the Cardinals last year. We got to just wait and see. You know, and we've been waiting.
I feel like, you know, obviously he won't be a down tight end, but, you know, the Cardinals don't have no tight end. So, if they, you know, I think he'll be a, not, and he won't be used as a tight end, but he'll be a tight end body type with, mm-hmm. with those mismatches that he, such as he did, you know, when BA got here, moving him into the slot, moving him around a little bit, motioning him here. You know, Larry's a great blocker too.
Yes, he is. He's always been.
So,
yeah.
And just having, you know, that presence in the room is definitely, can definitely go a long way. So, you know, I'm just like you. I guess we just all gonna have to wait and see what happens in the next couple of months.
Okay. Well, you got the first question wrong though.
Yeah, okay. I did.
Danny Vitale.
It's gonna be a bad week for me. See, I ain't coming excited today. So
we got him then. He's sleeping. Well, let's see. Talking about the Arizona Cardinals, Buda Baker is wearing number 3 because of which player?
Allen Iverson. I knew Allen Iverson always was his favorite player. That was easy.
Oh, you had insight to that. Yeah, insight. So let me give you guys an updated. You got that one, right? Let me give you guys an updated list of jersey changes in the National Football League. Darius Slay, he's wearing number 2, was 24. Leonard Fournette is wearing number 7. Chase Edmonds, 29-2. Matt Judon is wearing number 9. Quandre Diggs, 6. James Conner, number 6. Byron Murphy, your former teammate, he's wearing 7. Mark Ingram, number 2. Julio Jones, number 2. Hollywood Brown, 5. DJ Moore, 2.
Did you say Jalen Ramsey?
Is that official?
Yeah, I think so.
I know I saw him wearing number 5. I didn't know if that was official. I'm trying to figure out what number 5. Did he wear number 5 in high school? He wore 8 in college.
Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, I think it is official.
Yeah, I guess I would ask you which jersey number will look the best, but I think you're going to say number 7. So
all day.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay. So
hey, next question. I do like the number 2, too, because, you know, I wore that in high school in Little League.
And that eight smooth.
I like all single digits, honestly.
Yeah, that 8 smooth.
Especially right. Skill position guy.
No doubt. That's what we're going to see a lot. It's going to take a little getting used to, but it's going to be fun seeing some of the different numbers in the National Football League. All right, celebrity boxing matches continue. Who did Lamar Odom beat up on Friday night? With his saggy boxing pants. I ain't never seen a boxer had a sag.
Hey, I did see it. He pushed that man down. I forgot who he fought though.
Man, it was like two drunk uncles fighting. and one of them had a little nasty sag.
The funniest part though was when Lamar, I don't know if he was letting him get off on him or he just let him gain some confidence.
Man,
but dog, that was the most entertaining thing that I've seen on TV. Because I was watching on mute to my credit. But I okay. did see the fight. I don't know who he was fighting.
Yeah, he fought Aaron Carter.
Aaron Carter.
Yeah. But hey, check this out. Lamar had a 10-inch height advantage. Right, 11-inch.
It was a height disadvantage.
Who okayed that match?
Hey, the only thing that saved him was him having that helmet on, man.
Yeah.
Hey, and Lamar, it was almost like a nice clean left, though. Right up under
He did. And then it was like he was just kind of sunning him in the mat in the ring. He was just kind of mushing him with the glove. He wasn't really hitting him sometimes.
I can tell you who was the ref, though.
Who the ref was?
Chuck Icebox.
Icebox. UFC fighter. We might give you a half of that one.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy, but I did watch the fight, though. I just can't remember who he was fighting.
Aaron Carter. That's who it was.
Yep.
All right. All right. So wasn't your best effort. As you said, you came in kind of sleeping and we took advantage of you. That's why when you playing on the island, you got to always be ready.
Always be ready, Kat.
Yeah, you got to always be ready. So either you got one out of three correct or one and a half correct. We got to go to the committee and see exactly what happened. Now it's time for 7 questions. But guys, make sure you stay tuned. After halftime, Antrell Rowe will be joining us. So stay tuned. But 7 questions is where we get a chance to interact with you, the listeners, and the viewers. If you want your question to be answered in the future, leave a question attached to a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and we may get to it on the show. This week's question comes from real.drewbutler. Question for Pat P. Coming from real.drewbutler. Shout out to Drew. Thank you for your question. With Julio out of the NFC South, now, remember, Julio's now a Tennessee Titans player. Who is the top receiver in the NFC South, and why has it always been Mike Evans? Now, it seems like Drew is a bit biased because he said it has always been Mike Evans, who's a straight dog.
It definitely hasn't been always Mike Evans. But I think over the last 2 years, Mike Evans took that title.
Okay. Over the last 2 years.
Right. Yeah. So right now, it's definitely Mike Evans.
No question.
Hands down.
So when you look at
also going to come down to, you know, who's going to be quarterback and see if he can obviously continue that going. But if I had to take a pick without, you know, over the last 2 years, it was Mike Evans. I mean, Mike Evans. But
what about Michael Thomas?
I meant Michael Thomas. I thought my bad. Michael Thomas over the last 2 years has been the best receiver in the NFC South.
Yeah.
But with Mike Evans having Tom Brady and having many more opportunities to be elusive and have many more one-on-one coverages, Mike Evans will definitely take the title this year.
And in 2019, Michael Thomas had 149 catches in 2019. Great. So clearly in 2019, he was the best wide receiver in that division.
18 has some numbers too. He just didn't have many catches.
18, he had some numbers. Yeah. You got to realize that's what led to that record-breaking contract that he received a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But right now, with Julio out and not knowing exactly which direction the Saints will go at the quarterback position, hopefully it's our friend of the show, Jameis Winston, who we had on the show some episodes ago. Yep. If you missed it, check our feed, check the YouTube page. It's there. Insightful conversation with Jameis Winston, but hopefully it's Jameis Winston. But if it's not Jameis Winston, you don't know exactly what kind of numbers Thomas will provide. But I'm with you right now. It's Evans. Mm. Right now it's Evans, hands down. And it's safe to say, you know, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, they have two of the top three wide receivers in that division. If you want to throw in Chris Godwin, who would be number three behind Thomas, number two, and with Evans being number one. So they got some talent there in Tampa. But thank you, Drew Butler, for your question. Like I said, if you'd like to have your question show up in our show, make sure you leave a 5-star review attached to your question, and we'll try to get to it on the show. Now it's time for shout-outs. We also want to remind everyone that you can find us on Instagram at All Things Covered Pod. Each week we give clues for our next guest, and the first person to guess correctly gets a follow and a shout-out on the pod. So we have to shout-out Michael_MN19 for correctly guessing Derek Brown last week. Again, follow us at All Things Covered Pod for the very best content from the show. Now it's time for halftime. But on the other side of the break, we'll be joined by a Super Bowl champion, collegiate All-American, Antrell Rowe. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Ladies and gents, we back from halftime. If you guys been following the show, you know how we rock and roll. We go into halftime, make a few adjustments. We come out of halftime with a key addition to our squad as well. We gave you guys a hint early in the show who it is. Outstanding individual, a terror in the secondary, played cornerback, played nickelback, played safety, both safety positions. And me and Pat, P, we were having some issues in the secondary in the first half. So we went out and got a guy that can do it all. Spent 11 years in the National Football League, commanding hell in the secondary. Played for three NFL teams, Arizona Cardinals, the New York Giants, and the Chicago Bears. Super Bowl 46 champion, three-time Pro Bowler. 2005 first round draft pick. I will not say it, but he went to Miami. I'm not saying what most people say about that program, but he went to Miami where he was an All-American. My dog, my road dog, man, my compadre, friend of the show, Antrell Rowe, joined us here. All Things Covered, Pat Peterson, Brian McFadden. Rowe, how you doing?
Man, I'm on with two legends. I'm good, man. I'm rocking.
Hey, man, we appreciate you joining us, man. We know you got a lot going on, but let's start at the beginning. Before Antrell became a first-round draft pick, before Antrell became an All-American at Miami, how did your family and where you grew up influence your football career?
Man, they were everything. You know, I just always wanted to represent the name on the back. That was my home. That was always my number one priority. Just go out there and give it everything I got, you know. You know, we all were blessed with talent. We all have talent, but it's about, you know, what we put into that talent, what we challenge ourselves with. I think that was the key to my success. My parents, my family, you know, my family has always been there from the beginning. You know, they never missed a game. Brother and sister, you know, was always in my corner. My sister went to college, UCF. She's always there. My brother was always in my back pocket. So it was just us five, man. We always rock.
So let's go back to your high school days coming out of Dade County, a top graded top tier defensive back. I didn't know this, but you were locked and loaded to go to the University of Florida. What changed your mind and ultimately going to Coral Gables to Miami?
Listen, I was just locked and loaded on Florida just because I wanted something different. It's Miami. It made me need to get there. And then when I went to the Florida visit, I was blown away by it. And it was, you know, and looking back now in hindsight, a visit really doesn't mean anything, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
to impress you. Man, I went down to one UM practice, and that was all it took. Man, I saw them boys bang. And when I said, I thought they were literally trying to kill each other. And, you know, it's break time.
You know, I see Ed Reed give this boys gelling. I'm like, hey, you know, they were just trying to kill each other. What's this about?
Yeah. But
that's the intensity of their practice. That's how they made each other better. And I looked and I'm like, I need to be right here.
Right. So what was it like stepping on campus as a freshman in 2001 in that in the University of Miami locker room? Like, how was it?
Listen, it was honestly like a surreal year. Like, you felt like constantly prove yourself. And I don't mean every day, I mean every minute of the day. Because right. Those guys, you know, they had a certain standard that they played by, that they lived by, you know, on and off the field. You know, they had so many things that were not mandatory, but mandatory, you know, and it was all player, you know, self-imposed. And you just want to be a part of the guys, you know, want to go out there. And I was one of four guys who didn't get red. So, you know, my calling was special teams. You got to go out there and try to be a dog on special teams by any means necessary. And I've never in my life took so much pride in being a special team, being a gunner, being a whole guy in my life. And, you know, that was me and Sean T. Dog. And, you know, and we accepted that very much. And when we got in the game, they told us, we blow these cats out, we're going to blow them out. When y'all get in the game, if they score one touchdown, y'all ain't playing no more for the rest of the game. Knew they meant that, you know, because at that much pool, even over the coaches staff, like the players ran the team. Right. And, but man, the leadership was off all angles. You know, it didn't matter what position it was. We had a leadership. And I think that's also helped me carry my leadership skills over to, you know, teams that I played for.
So, Ro, you've called Sean Taylor the best teammate you ever had. What made Sean so special on and off the football field? And what makes someone a great teammate?
First and foremost about Sean, I just think that he possessed a talent that I think I've only seen once in his lifetime. It was with him. He was big. He was physical. He was a terror. Cover ground from any angle. He could go down and cover a receiver if he needs to. He's a bruiser. When he hits you, he's going to make you feel it. Mm-hmm. And people don't give him enough credit for his football IQ. The boy was a football player.
Yeah.
He found a way to get the ball. He found a way to get the ball. And when he got the ball in his hands, he knew exactly what to do with it.
And what was it like, what with Sean T being there? Obviously, we heard so many great stories with Sean T. What is one of the best Sean T stories you can give us?
I think when the coaches realized who he was, he did something. Put him like on third teams. And, you know, Sean just took his helmet off, went and sat down towards the end of the bench, didn't say nothing to nobody. Then, you know, coach called third team. Sean's lined up, you know, deep. And by the time he said, "Hut," the quarterback, "Hut," all you see is this blur, right? It's just flat. He left the deep third safety and just, in his mind, he was like, "I'm going to destroy any and everything." Point. And they end up handing the ball off to Jason Ellis. And when he made contact with him, all you heard was, "Blah!" Everything just came out of Jason Ellis' helmet. Every single thing. everything. Ear pad, chin strap. I think face mask was broke. And I'm like, "Bro, you're supposed to be in third." He didn't care. He was that mad because the coach had put him on third team. He didn't pout. He didn't do none of that. He just went and sat down and he was like, "I'm going to make a statement." Before Shannon hadn't sent him in the locker room, and he came back and looked at us and said, "That MF was crazy. Like, that dude crazy." Yeah, he is. But that's, you know, I mean, that dude, since the age of 6 years old, you know, we started playing together when we were 6 years old. And then I remember we played on the same team. I remember we switched teams. I went and played Florida City Razorback, like South Dade Rams. And I was at running back. He was at linebacker. And the coach was like, 28 sweep. And I look over to the right, and I see Sean over there linebacker. I'm like, nah, coach, 7 sweep. I'm going to the left.
Hey, you gave an audible?
Yeah, what? Hey, I gave audible at 8 years old. But Bruiser, man, that's always been him.
And speaking of Sean Taylor, I remember rolling. You probably remember this ball game, too. The year we played Miami twice, we played y'all in the regular season, and we played again in the Orange Bowl. And in that Orange Bowl matchup, remember, we had Greg Jones at the running back position. And you know, Greg Jones was, whew, he was a load. And Greg Jones ran an ISO, came through scot-free, got to the third level, and Sean came up. And that's the one time I saw Sean Taylor lose a battle. Greg Jones got lower, ran over Sean, kept going. And the very next play, I mean, like the next two or three plays, Pat P, watching Sean Taylor just go hit anything that was wearing the opposite color was a thing to see, as a thing of beauty from a defender standpoint. But offensively, I mean, guys were just targets. You can tell Sean Taylor was so mad that he lost that battle to Greg Jones. The next two, three plays, he was hitting anything that had garnet and gold on, and he was laying into them. And you guys know how it is. When you play football, you play defense. Like LeBeau used to tell us all the time in Pittsburgh, sometimes you get the bear, sometimes the bear gets you.
Right.
But when the bear gets you, you got to bite back.
Got
and
to.
Man, but Sean Taylor would bite. It was one place, and he didn't get a chance to get to the ball carrier, so he hit the closest thing that was to him, which was a wide receiver. They could be standing looking at the play away from them, and he just go, yeah. I mean, he was lighting them up left and right. And that just tell you the type of ball player he was. You know, if he didn't win a battle, like you said, Ro, he was coming. He felt some type of way. He was on third team. And, man, when he lost that battle to Greg Jones, boy, I mean, Greg pissed him off the wrong way. And our receivers definitely had to pay for that price. But when you look at your outstanding career at Miami, being a first-round selection, you dominated on the collegiate fields. In college, you covered one guy that's getting ready to go in the Hall of Fame in Calvin Johnson. And you also covered Larry Fitzgerald when he was at the University of Pittsburgh. And you, Pat P, listen to these numbers. In two ball games against those two players, Calvin Johnson and Larry Fitz, Roe only allowed 36 yards combined receiving. So, Antrell, who was the better pass catcher on the college field based on your experiences going against them? Calvin Johnson or Larry Fitz?
It was no comparison on college field. Larry Fitzgerald all day. Larry Fitzgerald was an absolute dog. And not saying that Calvin wasn't, but Calvin was still young. You know, Calvin was a baby when I covered him. I'm sure, you know, if I covered him later in his career, it might have been a different result. But, you know, he was still a youngster when I covered him. But Larry Fitzgerald was that dog. Like,
yeah.
He couldn't be covered. In my eyes, he couldn't be covered. So the only obstacle I had, the only thought that I had was, you know, going into that game, my coach wanted to double cover him. And I told him, no, we're not double covering him. Like, I want a man to man. And coach like, are you crazy? Like, listen, I said, listen, it's either you let me play him man to man, or you take him, you send another corner with him and let him have a shell over top. Cause I'm playing man to man. And I'm gonna get in him. I said, I'm gonna get in him. And he was like, what? I said, listen, if I'm not playing him man to man for somebody else in my spot, it's cool. But I said, I want a man to man. If he beat me, make him earn it. Like, he gonna have to show me that he gonna beat me. I'm not gonna give him the victory without him, you know, without me even being tested. I said, right. That ain't gonna happen. So what I did was I studied film all week. I studied film. Larry Fitzgerald wasn't a blazing guy. So I knew, you know, my strength was putting my hands on. So one thing I knew about Fitzgerald is if the ball touched his hand, it was caught. Like, it was nothing you're going to do. The ball was going to be caught. So my whole obstacle that whole week was challenging was, don't let the ball touch the receiver's hand. Don't let the ball touch the receiver's hand. His highest point, you couldn't jump with him. For some reason, he might not have the highest vertical, but his timing is impeccable. You remember Super Bowl. You know, his timing is impeccable. Ike, right there. Ike got his hand all in it, everything. Still come down with the ball. But that's who Fitz was. So I couldn't let him catch the ball. And we just had a great game plan. And he was challenged. You know, our goal with that game was to give it to Fitz. We didn't care about anybody on the team but to give it to Fitz. And he got it. You know, he ended up scoring at the end of the game. He went to the different side. And I think they ran like a cross around. And he scored in the game. I was mad because I wasn't on him. But, you know, man, he was the best I've ever seen at a wide receiver position in college football.
Yeah, Larry was on. I remember watching that game. Yeah, that was a hell of a game because you guys went down to Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that game. So, Ro, tell me this, because I had an opportunity to get recruited by Miami. Why does it seem like top recruits don't have the same interest in Miami as they used to?
Because they all going to Florida State.
Well, you know, well, he said it right, Florida State. Florida State and Miami pretty much on the same level right now. They ain't popping. They not popping right now. They ain't popping. Nah. It's not the same. You know, and I'll be honest and tell everybody, it's not the same. Listen, when we played Florida State back in the day, we knew, listen, this game can go either way because they got some dogs.
Right.
They got some dogs. And then like me being on defense side, right, and I know my offense, I know the receivers I go up against every day. Mm. And then I go and I see Matt Daddy at their corner. Then they end up getting the freak Cromartie at corner. I said, yeah, man, it's going to be a long day for these boys. And it just seemed like everything was so poised. Like, their defense was intact. In order for you to beat them, like, they had to be the ones to make a mistake. Like, because it was just, they scheme. It just seemed like it was just perfect at all times. I'm like, damn, like, are these boys really that good or is the scheme that good? But them boys played ball. So it was like that on both sides of the table, you know. Offensively, they had so many weapons. And then when they got Greg Jones, it was like, man, when y'all came out of Miami, he murdered us. He murdered us by himself. I think he had probably like 200 some yards.
Mm-hmm. At, oh, 02, it was that 02 matchup, 2002 matchup. Yeah.
Oh man, it was bad.
Wow, look.
It was bad. But they don't carry the same weight, man. It's the players are not the same. The leadership is not the same. And you know, I'm not a big fan of recruiting a guy because of the stars, 4 stars, 5 stars, this, that, and the other. I'm not saying that that's what they're doing, but whatever it is, it's not converting to being a dog on the field. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing enough dogs. You may have one, you might have two, but when we played, Matt, you know, we had 30, 40 dogs. Okay. We had dogs that weren't even touching the field.
I think that 2002 matchup, when we came down to Miami in the Orange Bowl, both teams combined to have like 35 pros.
Oh,
between easily. Us and Miami. 35 easily. Pros. Think about that.
Easily.
And might even be more.
We talk about some of the young guns and some of the young kids, but yeah, we had like, it was 30 plus pros between Miami and Florida State.
Yeah, but it's not the same. But you know, when you have schools with such tradition, like, you know, the LSUs, the Alabamas, you know, guys are leaning more towards those schools because they're producing, you know, even if they, you know, not sending 100 first round draft picks, and you know, LSU been killing it, Alabama been killing it. Those guys have been consistent, you know, top tier for at least the last 10 plus years. You know, they're the epitome of college football, you know, the Clemsons of the world now. Those guys are playing ball. And, you know, when you get kids from South Florida, you know, we follow the trend. We follow, okay, let's see what's popping. Let's see what guys are excelling. Let's see, you know, and your program got to be booming. If it ain't booming, they're not gonna go just because it's the youth, you know.
And back to credit your response, I definitely agree with that, because when I came out, it was between 2007 and 2008 when I was getting recruited by Miami. Like you said, it wasn't the same, you know, because I'm a huge UM fan, was a huge UM fan growing up, watched every single game on Saturdays. But going through that recruiting process, it was like, it feels a little different. Like you said, going to practice, seeing the guys, you know, wanting to kill each other. And next thing you know, they all buddy-buddy, hanging tight. But once it's back in between those lines, it was totally different. And I just didn't get that same feel, because I used to come down there and watch you guys. I forget what they used to do with you guys. It's like the springtime when they used to let the fans and stuff come watch you guys.
Spring Fest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think you remember this, but that's like around when that Nike camp had just came out, and they used to host it at the University of Miami.
Yeah.
It used to be a great time coming down there and seeing all you guys, Sonores, you. I remember seeing Devin Hester down there. So to credit your response, like I said, it definitely wasn't the same. You know, I think, you know, getting those guys, I think, like you said, once the recruiting process came such a big deal, I believe they just started wanting to go after those 5-star guys so they can be a top ranked recruiting.
Right.
But yeah, it definitely wasn't the same. That's why I didn't go there.
I feel you. I feel you, because we started having that drop off my last year.
Yeah.
You know, I just noticed that the guys we were bringing in weren't the guys that left before me.
Right.
And they weren't like myself. They were. It was different, you know. It was a different ball game, and I noticed it. I noticed it. So when, you know, when Miami started that decline, you know, I wasn't surprised.
Right.
Let me throw a date out to you. See if you remember this date. November the 18th, 2007. What happened on that date?
November.
Yeah.
November
18th, 2007.
I'm in Arizona at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's my third year.
Yep.
Is that Cincinnati game?
Yeah. Cincinnati. You tied the NFL record with two pick six in the same game off of Carson Palmer, Cincinnati Bengals quarterback at that time. You a record-setting day, to say the least. I don't even know if a Cardinals player has done that since. Two pick sixes in the same ball game.
Eric might have to check this. I think Rashad Johnson did it against Detroit.
Two pick sixes in the same game?
If I'm not mistaken.
Well, during that day, the 18-07, Roll tied the NFL record that day with those two pick sixes. What do you remember about those two plays? Break it down for us, the sequences of picking the ball off and taking them to the house two times.
Well, it was supposed to be three.
One it was supposed to be three.
Yeah, I had three that game. They called one back. So it was supposed to be a record, but it got called back because Antonio Smith knocked Carson Palmer out.
Oh, and it's a personal foul.
Personal foul, yeah.
You supposed to have three?
It was three to the house. It was three. And that's still a sting, too, to this day, because I would have been, you know, in the books by myself. Now I got to share it with people. I got to share it now, yeah. But that game, man, I had a little personal vendetta. I wasn't starting. That year, I got demoted. I was a third corner. Mm-hmm. Coach, you know, we had a new coach, Coach Wisenhunt. He brought his guys in who he wanted to play. I was like, cool, you know, I'm not going to pout. I'm not going to put my head down. This guy don't know who I am. But eventually, I'm going to get the opportunity. I'm going to show him who I am. So, you know, Chad and I had mutual friends, and he told one of my friends, oh, yeah, I'm going to give your boy that business this week. But I can't really do too much to him because he didn't start.
Yeah.
That hit me a little different.
Mm-hmm.
It just hit me different. It hit me so different. So I got locked and loaded in on that film that week. I knew third and 3-6. In a certain formation, they're throwing that out to Houston Mazzotta no matter what. He getting the out.
Yeah.
He's getting the out. And it's going to be a quick out. And I say one thing about Carson Palmer, he was so confident in his arm, he didn't care if you were covered or not. He felt like he could get in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was 3rd and 5. I said, the out coming. So I played him. I pressed him.
You were pressing, okay.
I was pressing. And within the press, when he was going to cut, I kind of eased off a little bit so I can get my foot in that ground and break. So when I break, I broke right up under that out.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. Boom. I stiffed on him. You know, gave him a little whistle-dizzle. You know, gave him a few moves. Got to the end zone. The second play, I would line up at nickel. I can show like I was in free safety, but I already knew what I had coming. I had to go down there. We're playing cover two, inside route, you know, slant, let that number two go to number one.
You know, back, yeah, number one running the slant too, number two running the slant.
Yeah, they come with a double follow. I know it's
no
coming.
Question. They wanted you to take that number two so that number one can be wide open.
So what I did was I followed that number two in a little bit.
And dropped them.
And then I just dropped back. Boom. Another one to the house. Gone. Then the last one I had to the house, I was at safety. You know, they were getting desperate. They were trying to score. Mm-hmm. I was at safety. You know, we got some pressure on Carson Palmer. He threw it straight down the middle. I was at safety. Boom. I got it. Boom. That one was probably like 70 yards. Took that one to the house, and that's where the penalty came in because
Antonio.
Who was it? Oh, Antonio. Antonio cleaned his clock. And it was a legal hit, but just because back then it was on the quarterback, we called a personal foul. You know, it wasn't a nasty hit. It wasn't nothing outrageous. He just blocked him, but he got him good. Yeah. And, you know, they called it back. So I ended up with three interceptions with two touchdowns.
Oh, boy. Boy, you're talking about a day.
And that's the day Coach Wisenhunt realized who I was. Like, I remember going to the locker room that day, and, like, I had tears in my eyes because I was so angry, man. I was just holding in so much anger because I'm like, this guy benched me. For one, they got me playing 9 yards off. Had to play 9 yards off, you know, the years before. And I'm like, I'm not that corner. I'm a press guy. Right. If you let me do what I do, you'll see a different result. But, you know, nevertheless, I was going to find my way no matter what. One thing I always knew, that I was a ball player. It didn't matter because I played nickel, I played safety, I played corner. So anywhere you put me, I'm going to excel. So once they started letting me get around that ball, then they started figuring out who I was. And I always told myself, I said, listen, if I ever get the chance, and it wasn't nothing personal, but it was personal. I said, if I ever get the chance, one day I'm going to make him beg me. Mm-hmm. I said, one day I'm gonna make him beg me. So when that free agency came around, I got my wish. And they could have offered me the house. Honestly, I wasn't going back to Arizona just because of principle. You know, I felt a certain type of way. I wasn't going back to Arizona. My mind was made up before any negotiations even started. I wasn't going back there because I was a man of principle. I felt like I really wasn't given a fair shake. And then I ended up making my way. And now you want me to stay. I said, but I'm gone. I'm gonna go take my talents to South Beach.
Hey, I love it. So now you're talking about, obviously, in that 2007 game, you just alluded to playing different positions. You played nickel, you played safety. So what went into the move in 2008 to turn your career into a safety? Like, what was the adjustments? Like, what went into that thought process of finally moving from down to the line of scrimmage back a little bit more?
So when I played at University of Miami, I played corner. You know, I was always pretty much like the boundary corner a lot of times. And I always played against the number one receivers. And then I also played nickel. So I got used to being in action, you know, a lot of tackling, a lot of covering slot receivers. I was just more around the ball than just being specifically a corner. And the way the Arizona Cardinals had me playing, they had me playing off a lot of the times. And I just felt like I was isolated and I wasn't showing my talents. Like I wasn't getting around the ball. Mm. You know, it just didn't suit me. And at the end of the 2007 season, coach asked me, he said, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to play corner or do you want to play safety? I said, man, listen, I just want to be around the ball. Just let me be free. You know, let me use my football instincts. Let me use my film study. And I want to be around the ball. So then I just started playing safety and I played nickel a lot of times too. So I love when I made that change. I think it definitely excelled my career. And more importantly, I felt like I was able to, you know, to display my talents, you know, because I was a man who could play corner, who could play safety, who could play nickel, who could do multiple different things. And I think it let me excel who I was and show who I was as a person.
So Trev, give us the fans, because we have a lot of Arizona fans on that's on All Things Covered. Explain your time in Arizona.
Oh man, my time in Arizona was a great time because when I first got there, listen, we were horrible. You know, we were horrible. I was like, you know, coming from a program like University of Miami, and then you go into a losing program where you win in four games in a season, then you win in five games in a season. Like, man, what is this? Right. You know, I'm not used to this. And the players just got together. You know, we got together, then we started getting more dolls and more people started coming in, and we just started seeing things form. And then we started noticing, okay, we're losing, but we're giving up. We giving these guys some battle. Like, these guys, like, they feeling us. We losing, but they feeling us now. And then we just started coming together. Guys just started forming together. We started getting pieces. We started getting, you know, perfect pieces to the puzzle. And eventually, you know, we formed a team. We had some dogs on the offense side of the ball. We had some dogs on the defense side of the ball. And, you know, we made that run. You know, we ran to those Steelers, man, who also had a loaded team. That right. team, listen, that team shouldn't have been beat. You know, we gave them a run for their money, but that team shouldn't have been beat because they honestly, they were stacked at each and every position. Yep. And we were the underdogs, and we were just scrappy. We were a very, very scrappy team, but they were the better team. You know, and I knew that. So that's why when we talk about that Super Bowl, I'm like, yeah, it hurt, but I'd rather take that hurt because if I got to lose that way, I'd rather lose that way a million times. Right. Lose that way by a miraculous catch. But I said, listen, they earned it. They deserved it. Yeah. You know, and you got to take your hat off to those guys, man. Like, listen, it was all, you know.
No doubt. And the thing I like about the Cardinals that 2008 season, they reminded us of who we were in 2005. You know, we barely yeah. got into the playoffs, but when we got into the playoffs, we were playing some of our best football.
Right.
And our confidence was super, super high. And Ro, talking about when you first got to AZ, I mean, when you first got there, they only had one playoff appearance in 23 years. So clearly, you know, they were inconsistent, you know what I mean, in the wrong way. But you guys all changed that, and you had a big part to play in the change of the direction of the organization and currently where they are right now. And speaking of that 2008 championship game in Tampa, you were a part of two iconic plays, right? One was a Santonio Holmes catch you was on the field for. The other was a James Harrison interception return where you were on the field, but because of your body position, it kind of change the direction of your teammate in Larry Fitzgerald. And oh, by the way, I'm happy you were standing where you were standing, because if you weren't there, the likelihood of Larry Fitz making that tackle Pat P before Debo got to the end zone was likely. And that helped us because we needed that play. But just talk about, because what people don't understand, Ro, for us being players, we know how it feels to be standing on the football field, watching the Jumbotron and not realizing where you at, because you're away from the plate. You're on the opposite side where the ball was actually placed at on the goal line. And ultimately, the unthinkable happened. And now James Harrison is going the opposite direction, trying to get in the end zone. Take us through that play in that scenario, because when you watch the highlight, you see 21, but it's almost like you didn't realize where you were and who was around you. And Larry Fitzgerald had to kind of run that hump to avoid you to try to make that tackle.
Right. So, man, it was a crazy turn of events, right?
Like, no question.
Right before the halftime, you know, like, I don't know if it was just instincts. I don't know what it was. And I just had a bad feeling. I just had a bad feeling that something was going to go down. Like, it just, I'm like, okay, we're going into halftime. You got less than a minute left. You know, I just felt like something was just going to go wrong. And when I saw him drop back in coverage and get that interception, I was honestly in shock. It felt like my body went numb, because I'm like, damn, you know, did I speak this into existence? You know, and like, it felt like my body went numb. And honestly, when I think about it now, I'm just looking, I'm like, I honestly felt like I was going to go trip this dude. That's what I felt like. That's what I felt in my body. And I'm stopping myself. But I didn't realize how close I was, you know, to the boundary line.
Yeah.
But man, like, listen, when he got the interception, you know, people talk about the run back and all this stuff, but what I pay attention to on that interception is the blocking that y'all have for him. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Y'all B.I. players up. Y'all literally manhandled him. And I was mad about that. I'm like, y'all manhandled everybody who was trying to get him. They literally manhandled him. And Larry Fitzgerald got bumped out of bounds. You know, unfortunately, I happened to be, in that space, and he had to run. And he ran it to me, actually, kind of slow his progress down and had to run around and stuff like that. So, yeah, if he hadn't ran it to me, he definitely would have caught Debo. But, you know, I tell people all the time, yeah, that was a crucial turning point in the game, but we still went up, you know, in that game. We still went up. Mm-hmm. So no matter what happens, you know, the game still played out exactly the way it was supposed to be played, and the better team won. Did we have a shot? Absolutely, we had a shot. But the better team won that day, and I can say, and I can accept that.
And talking about the blocking, the week of preparation, while we were practicing at South Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
I saw the footage.
Y'all boys know how it is, right? Late in the season, you catch an interception against a scout team, you might not go hard to return it. You might get a little lazy, throw the ball back, get ready for the next play. So we were doing that. We were catching the ball, and it was in the rain, but we wasn't returning. Mike T, Dick LeBeau, they called and said, listen, man, when y'all catch an interception, I need the cavalry in front of the ball, the man with the ball, and y'all run to score. Because if y'all do it now, y'all going to do it on Sunday. And, you know, we hear those things from coaches. We hear it, and it kind of doesn't really resonate like that. We're like, okay, we're going to do what coach say do. So after that speech, every time someone caught an interception, it didn't matter if it was the first group, second group, or the third group. Whoever was on the football field, you caught an interception, you better go find someone to block, and you return it all the way to the house. And literally, when that play happened, we got into halftime. He's like, yo, that's why great coaches coach great teams. They put you in positions to be successful. You just got to listen. And you talk about that blocking. That was a huge, huge point of emphasis for us, because we weren't doing that on Wednesday practice, but that Thursday, Friday practice, every time someone caught an interception, we got to go.
Right.
We got to go.
I saw the footage of that, and I forgot where they showed that footage, but I think they were going through the scenario of that play and how it happened. And then they were showing the footage of y'all in practice.
Yep.
Blocking, everybody running, crawling, getting the man in front of you, knocking them out. And I was like, practice made perfect, man.
No
question. You know, that it becomes second nature. And that's all that was. When he got that ball, man, I saw y'all literally beat our guys up. You beat them up. Made them look like little boys on the field. But that's because y'all were prepared for that.
Yeah. So how did it feel being on the good side when Mario Manningham made that catch on the sideline versus Antonio Brown making that catch in Super Bowl, whatever.
Santonio Holmes
making that catch in the Super Bowl.
Listen, man, it felt good to be on the other side for a change, man. Listen, it felt
that was
good.
A great catch by Mario, too, boy.
Oh, my goodness. The safety couldn't have played it any better.
No question.
He couldn't have played it any better.
No question.
He couldn't have played it any better. And Eli, you know, he's a different monster, man. He's a different monster. And he just put that ball right there, right in that honey hole, right in that sweet spot. And Mario, I don't know. I still don't know how he made that catch.
And but got that's both Mario. Feet inbounds.
Yeah. Both feet inbounds. Awesome catch on the outside of that shoulder. It was just great offense beating great defense. That's exactly what that was.
Hey, so Ro,
go ahead.
I was going to ask Ro, your unbiased answer. Which catch was better, Santonio Holmes or Mario Minahans?
Santonio Holmes all day.
Yeah.
I don't think you can compare the two. Because Santonio Holmes, how he caught it, the defense scheme that we have for it, the timing of it is, man, listen, that's outside of, to me, that's the best catch I've ever seen, you know, but the best catch I've ever seen was Odell Beckham, you know, behind the head. That's freakish. That, man, that dude freakish. He freakish anyway. But the best moment, like the pure moment of catch, Santonio Holmes.
Hey, you know, hey, Ro and Pat, you remember when we had Brandon Jacobs on the show some months ago? We had a little back and forth because he felt like the David Tyree catch.
Yeah, it was better.
Was better, the helmet catch. But my argument was this, Ro. My argument was Santonio Holmes' catch is better because it was more skill and structure than anything. The Tyree catch involved skill, but it was a lot of luck.
A lot of luck
involved in that. You know what I mean? Like, he probably could never do that catch over again if you paid him. But Santonio, just the toe tap, the hand placement, and if you look at where Big Ben threw the ball, it went over, like, three defenders. I remember Ralph Brown. It barely missed Ralph Brown's fingertips.
Yeah.
And it just dropped.
And just it literally just dropped, man. And he was stretched out like a ballerina, man. Just – listen, it's like I tell people all the time. If I got to lose like that, I will lose like that a million times out of a million times. Because
what was the coverage I was in?
Had to be look like.
don't make me talk about the coverage.
Because Rod Hood was on that team, wasn't it?
Yeah, Rod was on that team.
Was I like in cover two or cover four? What was the coverage?
I'm gonna let you be a corner. I'm gonna let you dissect this.
But okay.
We was in a box coverage.
Yeah, that's okay. What it was.
Box. Hey, so Ro, put your coaching hat on for us because we got a lot of viewers and listeners that might not know exactly what a box coverage is. So go ahead and put your coaching hat on and break it down for our listeners and our viewers.
Okay, so for that on that side, mm-hmm. You have four.
And that
guys.
Was to the wide side, right? That was to the field.
Yeah, it was to the field.
Yeah.
So on the back side, we was pretty much playing kind of like a man to man with a guy hanging low. And on that side where the play happened, we're supposed to have a guy that's playing the flat, which mm-hmm. is the low guy, the low outside guy. We had a high outside guy, which is supposed to be exactly where Santonio Holmes caught that ball. Then we have a low inside guy for anything that's coming underneath. And then we have a high inside guy. So they ran that play a couple times earlier in that game.
Yep.
And actually, the play right before that, same play to the other side.
Yep.
And being overthrew him. Mm-hmm. So the coach knew exactly what was coming and put us in the perfect coverage if the coverage was ran the right way.
Yeah.
The perfect coverage. So mind you, we have a low outside guy and a high outside guy. They threw the ball exactly where the high outside guy is supposed to be.
So the high outside guy went and tacked the lower route, the shorter route, and left the hole.
He attacked the shorter route.
This guy just a little bit.
He attacked the shorter route. Yeah. When Ben Roethlisberger threw the ball, dropped down low, and it left the open air. Francisco tried to do the best he can to try to come over there and make a play, but it was greatness.
Yeah.
It was greatness.
That's why football is the ultimate team sport. You can have 10 people doing what they're supposed to do and one person not doing what they're supposed to do. It messes up the entire thing.
Exactly right. It was exactly right.
And I wanted to bounce back real quick to playoff Eli. Like, how, like, what was different? What was the, I guess, the switch that went on for him during the playoffs? Because he was a different quarterback in the playoffs versus the regular season.
Oh, was man. It,
like, what you think went into playoff Eli?
Listen, I wish I knew the answer to that, but I don't. I just know that, you know, Eli, he has a certain demeanor about himself, and people they misunderstand Eli. You know, they think he, you know, because it's, that's just his look. That's just the look of the man face. Like, he can't do nothing about that. But Eli is honestly definitely one of the most prepared guys and confident guys I've ever played with. And more importantly, I know when that time comes, he's going to ride. And, you know, I never really had experience to play with him in the playoffs, but throughout that playoffs, I'm just seeing a different guy. I'm seeing a more rugged Eli. I'm seeing a tougher Eli. I'm seeing a dude that is willing to stand the paint and endure whatever beatings he is going to endure in order to make sure his team is successful. And that's the Eli who we saw during the playoffs. It was a guy that there was no holes barred. He was standing in the paint no matter what. And listen, I've never seen a quarterback get beat up as much as I saw Eli get beat up playing against San Francisco. They demolished him.
And that San Francisco defense was tough too.
Oh my God.
They had some dogs.
Yeah. I kept saying to myself, that's it. Like, he ain't getting up. He ain't getting up. I kept saying, that's it. Like, oh man, they keep getting to him. That's it. And Eli get up with that look, shrug his shoulders, fix that, and come right back. I was like, he made me a fan that day. I always liked Eli as a quarterback, but he made me a fan that day. I was like, that's a bad white boy. I said, boy, that's a bad white boy. Hey, listen, and you know, he carried us, man. He carried us, just his mentality, his leadership. Like, I don't think Eli got enough credit for, you know, I can't speak about Super Bowl prior to when I was there, but the Super Bowl that I was a part of, he played a tremendous part. And I'm not just talking about just what he contributed on the field. I'm talking about also off the field.
So is Eli Hall of Famer?
Yes. He is, for sure. He is definitely a Hall of Famer. He's earned that right. He's had that career. I think he's definitely a Hall of Famer.
Oh, I got a good one for you then, Ro. You play with another Hall of Fame quarterback in Kurt Warner. So if you had to take one, who you taking, Eli or Kurt Warner?
I think I would – it depends on what are we talking about? We're just talking about just straight quarterback.
One game. You need to win one game. Because you talked about playoff Eli going to a whole nother level. And Kurt Warner did some pretty good things too.
I've seen Kurt Warner, you know, we were playing against Green Bay. It was just nothing that we can do. You know, it was just nothing that we can do. Aaron Rodgers was, I'm talking about, Mac had some coverage sometimes. And I honestly felt bad for Mac that game because his coverage was so tight. Mm-hmm. When I tell you so tight, it was so tight that it couldn't be any better. And Aaron Rodgers was throwing that ball, the back of the receiver's ear. He was throwing to the ankles. I'm like, there's nothing that you can do. There's honestly nothing that you can do. And that guy went into a mold, man. I was like, we went into a cold. Kurt, you got to keep scoring, man. We ain't going to stop him.
And he kept scoring, too.
Yeah. I didn't know he was even capable of that. But I was like, Aaron Rodgers is something different. But I will still have to go for one game, I'm going to take Eli. I'm going to take Eli for one game. And that's a very, very hard decision to make because – you know, the surgeon, Kurt, put that glove on. He go to work.
that little saggy glove.
He go to work. But I think that if you put Kurt Warner in the game against San Francisco, I don't think you have that same outcome.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know if Kurt would have been able to endure what Eli endured in that game. And that's the only reason why I make the decision that I said.
Yeah, because that was – you guys were in San Francisco that playoff game.
In San Francisco. And they had them dogs in that team.
Justin Smith, Patrick Willis, Bowman.
Alden Smith.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Carlos Rogers.
Carlos Rogers.
Carlos Rogers.
38.
Deshaun Ghostin.
Yeah, yes, who were coming in the head first.
Dante Whitner.
I think Amon Brooks was on that team also. Amon Brooks.
Brooks was on that team, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They I was surprised. I honestly, I don't know how y'all won that game. Anyway, I was surprised.
it was a punt.
It was boom. Two of them.
Yeah, two. He dropped two like back to back.
It was a battle of defenses that game because we knew they had a kicker that honestly, if they got to the 50, it was a possibility he could have made a kick, a 67-yard field goal. It was possible. It was possible he could have made it. So we as a defense, we were like, listen, we can't let them cross half field. We can't. Because if they cross half field, they won't just keep kicking field goals. So it was a defensive battle the entire game.
Hey, last question for you, Ro, before we transition to the superlative part of this show. I know you're still much involved in the New York Giants. And currently, you know, the expectations are getting higher for the ball club this season with all the additions they've made offensively and defensively. You know, you look at another year, Daniel Jones will have under his belt. You get a healthy Saquon Barkley back. You know, Bradberry played good football. You signed Odoree Jackson. You got Leonard Williams. You know, Galladay was a big acquisition from the Detroit Lions. What are your expectations for the Giants this upcoming season? And what do they need to do to turn the corner?
I think you know, Judge, they have a coach that they believe in. I think they have a coach that understands them as an entirety. It's time for them to get back to playing ball. It's time for them to get back to winning. I think they've had so many losing seasons at this point with a lot of key players that can put you in position to win, but I think it was just about them gelling as a team. And I think they found themselves throughout a lot of the parts of last year. Guys are still young. Then, you know, Saquon Barkley going down, that hurt them tremendously. Mm-hmm. But I think with the key additions that they have, and I think now with, you know, you got Logan Ryan back there, he's playing some good ball at safety. You got Jabril Peppers. You have Bradberry that played just as well as, you know, pretty much any corner in the league last year.
Yeah.
Not maybe having the splashes of a lot of corners, but man to man, you know, he played a lot of good ball, a lot of pass breakups, and that's huge for a corner because that's hard to do. You know, we all know that we've all been on that island. So I think now it's the guys that they've had there, the Ingrams, the Sterling Shepherds. I think once those guys play to the level of expectations that we all think that they can play at, and then with the key additions that they have now, I think they can be a team that can be they can be a team to be reckoned with.
Yeah, do you think Daniel Jones is the guy?
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
You about to ask that question with great minds think alike. You think Daniel Jones is the guy?
I think Daniel Jones, I can't say he's the guy because, you know, it's only been 2 years for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see some great things from him. Then you see some times when he get pretty sloppy. It seems like he forces a lot of passes.
Right.
You know, he has to do better with protecting the ball. And, you know, they show, you know, he put a little muscle on, you know, in the offseason and stuff like that. Do I think that's going to transition to football? I don't really think so, but I think his mindset and who he needs to be for that organization and who they expect him to be. I think he has the skill set, but I think, you know, he has a lot of work to do. He needs to do a lot of studying. He needs to feel very comfortable within himself and believe in himself that he can go out there and get it done. And I think he can be the guy, but I don't think he's the guy just yet.
So long story short, this is a make or break year for Daniel Jones. It has to be.
No doubt about it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And I think his biggest problem is, like Antra alluded to, is just turning the ball over. I
mean, oh, no question. You can't win if you turn the ball over.
Protect the ball. And obviously missing Saquon Barkley is a huge, you know, dent in the offense. But as a quarterback, you can't turn that ball over because you're giving the opposite team more possessions. So if he understands what he needs to do to in order to put his team in a winning position, which is converting on third down, putting the ball in the right place and limiting those turnovers, I think he can be the guy because he got all the athletic ability. He's he got a little bit of mobility in him, very strong arm. I think the offense fit with Jason Garrett being there as the offensive coordinator, I think that tailor-makes his game a little bit. But it's just going to come down to Daniel Jones.
No question.
Turning the ball over.
If he falls on his face this year, not literally speaking, but just from production, they're going to look elsewhere in 2022. I think right now the NFL is only giving these young quarterbacks 3 years.
Yeah.
You got 3 years to really show you could be the future. You know, we saw what happened with the Jets and Sam Darnold. I mean, you got 3 years to show, you know, what they can, you know, hang their hat on your shoulders to be successful. If not, they're going to be looking elsewhere. So I agree with you guys. I think this is a make or break year for Daniel Jones. Now we're going to transition to the superlative part of the show. Ro, we want your unbiased, honest answer. First question for you. Hurricanes Mount Rushmore. We had Santana on the show a few episodes ago. I'm going to read you his Mount Rushmore, right? His top four players to ever play for the University of Miami. He had Michael Irvin, Gino Toretta, Edgerrin James, Ed Reed. So who is your Mount Rushmore of Hurricane players?
Okay, so I'm going to go two defense. I'm going to go two offense.
Gotcha.
So for defense, I'm going to take Sean T.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to take Dan Morgan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take Dan Morgan. Offensively, I'm going to take Ken Dorsey.
Ken Dorsey was a bad boy, man.
I'm going to take the collegiate Ken Dorsey.
So you're taking Ken Dorsey out of, when you look at all the iconic quarterbacks, you know, Bernie Kosar, Gino Toretta, Jim Kelly, you taking Ken Dorsey over all of them?
I think his collegiate career is better than theirs. Do I think he possesses the same talents or, you know, make transition to NFL? No. But his collegiate quarterback career, I'm taking Ken Dorsey. And just because, I might be a little biased just because I know Ken Dorsey was a 6'5", skinny white boy leading a whole team of brothers, and he was a general.
Mm-hmm.
He was a general. We followed what Ken Dorsey wanted. Like, he was a general. And for me, that spoke volumes to me because I've never, ever seen that before. I didn't see that before.
Yeah.
And you know, we follow suit. And then offensively, I'm going to go Mount Rushmore. I want to say Andre Johnson, but I'm going to take Santana Moss just because of his ability at wide receiver, also his ability at punt return.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So Dan Morgan, Sean T, Santana, and Dorsey.
Yep, right.
Okay.
Best atmosphere you ever played in?
Ooh.
It could be college or in the league.
Ooh. Best atmosphere I've ever played in. I'm not going to say Super Bowl because that's obvious.
Right.
I would probably have to say either Seattle or Philly.
Yeah.
Because Philly, they get wild in Philly.
Especially at night. They get rowdy during the daytime, but nighttime.
It's something different.
It's different at night.
They get wild out there.
All right. Next question for you. Ooh, this is a tough one here. Start, sit, cut. Who you starting, who you going to sit, and who you cutting? You got Willis McGahee, Clinton Portis, Frank Gore.
Wow.
Okay. So, yeah, listen to me with this one.
Okay.
Are we talking about college?
We're talking about college. Yeah,
college.
We're talking about college.
Before Frank Gore got injured, he was the best I had ever seen till this day.
I heard that.
The best. Listen to what I'm saying.
The vision, cuts. Yeah, he was cool.
The best I've ever seen till this day. Never seen nothing like it. Till this day, I've never seen nothing like that Frank Gore before he got injured.
What was so special about him before the injury?
Man, he was just different. He wasn't the fastest guy, but you weren't going to catch him if you go.
You couldn't tackle him.
You couldn't tackle him. That was the only running back ever in my career I could not tackle.
Yeah,
and I'm talking about have a clean shot. I have a clean shot on him. And it's either he cut off of both feet and he never slowed down. It felt slow. But you could never get him.
Yeah.
You could never get him. And then he'll get you off balance and hit you with a stiff arm.
Mm-hmm.
Then he ran literally this low to the ground and never changed speeds. Never changed speeds. Some players, they'll give you this and have a shift and this. He never changed speed. When he cut, he never changed speed. So I'm going to
start Frank.
Start Frank.
Okay.
Sit Portis. No, we're talking about college, right?
We're talking about college. Everybody healthy. Hey, Ro, everybody healthy. No injuries. Because McGahee had a devastating injury in college also. So everybody healthy. No scratches.
Yeah. Man, McGahee, that season McGahee had. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he had like seven touchdowns against Virginia Tech or something like that. I remember.
Oh, man. Nah, he carried out to him. He carried out to him.
McGahee.
I'm still. I just. I'm still gonna have to. I'm gonna start Frank.
Gotcha.
I'm gonna sit Portis. It's just something about that sweetness. Portis is he just sweet, man. It was
smooth too.
Portis was smooth, man.
Portis was just a great combination of all of the
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And then I'm gonna have to cut Willis. I just have to settle for it.
I can see that. That's okay. The right I would have
won. That's a tough one.
It is a tough one, but that's the right
I would have won. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So your first purchase after signing the richest safety deal with the Giants.
My first purchase. Well, I already had everything I wanted.
Yeah, I'm gonna say you already had it. But hey, but it ain't nothing like when you get the second contract.
Right. You're right. Right. Oh man, I can't even remember honestly at that point. I don't think it was nothing crazy. Nothing crazy, man. Because you know, at that point, once you have your house and you have your cars,
yeah, and you had that he had the red Mazda, the red Mazzy,
hey,
the
two door. Hey, I still got it next to
Smooth. Smooth. Hey, you still got your old school too?
I still got the dunk.
Hey, Pat, he got a nice dunk, man. Pat. He got a nice dunk, Pat.
I already know, man. We're from Florida, man. That's what we saw and grew up.
That's right.
Hey, bro, what you had the 4Gs on there? Where was the 4G autos?
I got the 4G autos on there. Yeah, I got 26 4G autos on there.
Yes. Hey, what I need you to do, text me a picture of the dunk, and then when we actually officially drop this, we're going to have it in the YouTube show.
All right, I got you.
So we're going to put the dunk. He got a mean dunk, Pat. You ain't never seen his dunk, huh?
I think it's blue, right?
No, it's red. It's candy apple red.
Candy red. I don't think it's mean. What you got underneath the hood, bro?
It's a 502.
Ooh.
It's running.
Big block.
It's running. Yeah, it's running. It's the big block. Yeah.
Hey, since you already had everything on your richest contract, so I'm ask you another one. What was your best interception? Your favorite interception, not your best one. Your favorite interception.
My favorite interception.
They could be in practice because we know a lot of great interceptions happen in practice. Oh, too.
People don't even see it.
Yes, they do. Yes. But probably my favorite interception was against the Rams. It was against the Rams. It was 2008 season. I started off, you know, at the beginning of the play, I started off, I think, close to the line of scrimmage. I was roaming at nickel. I was roaming. And I started off at the line of scrimmage. And by the time the ball was hiked, I was like midfield. And then I ended up all the way back. It ran like a deep post. I ended up picking off that ball against the Rams. And that was probably my favorite interception just because I worked so hard. And you know what I mean? Like that wasted energy. I worked so hard trying to disguise and everything like that. Once I got the interception, you know, I ran it back for probably 50 yards. But if I wasn't so tired, I could have definitely took it to the house. But right. I think that was probably my favorite interception.
That's dope.
Mm, good. Hey, I gotta throw this one in there, Ro. Best Boo Ray player you played against.
Who? The Boo King himself, Mac Daddy, baby. And Mac got that. Mac got the title. I give it to him. Cause you know what? I've never seen Mac.
Man, Mac is the only one at that table sober, man. Damn.
Yeah, you so
cheap. Hey, my fault y'all wanna play cards under the influence. Hey, my fault. Hey, but hey, Pat P. Hey, no question. Hey, we already trying to put something together in Miami. We're gonna have some boo players. Roll already gave me the insight. Pat P, I need you there. Yep. Hey, we gonna have a nice little weekend, a little shindig together. You know what I'm saying? We're gonna find a nice location.
I'm gonna be down there for the Rolling Loud, the 23rd through the 25th. When y'all thinking about doing this? I'm gonna be down there from July 23rd through the 25th.
And I'm gonna be gone. My son got the World Jiu-Jitsu Tournament in Orlando on the 24th. So I'm gonna be gone then. But we'll figure something out.
We got time. We got time. All we need is like a good 2 days. That's it, a day and a half. That's it. Get everybody down there, and somebody gonna get Bop City, and we gonna break bread together, and we gonna boo each other.
Oh yeah.
We're gonna boo each other.
Trap down there too, man. Ain't seen Trap in a while, man.
Yeah, let's get all the boys together, man. Let's get all the boys together, man. Have a Boo Ray Festival, man. Boo Ray Festival, man.
Oh, yeah, that'll be good.
Man, thank you for joining us here. All things covered. Pat Peterson, Brian McFadden, man. Pleasure is ours. Definitely insightful, entertaining conversation, man. Friend of the show, you're always welcome to join us at any given time. And don't forget to send me that picture that dunk. And we're gonna keep people involved about this Boo Ray date that we're gonna have set up and let everybody know who's gonna be there.
I appreciate y'all, man. Love y'all boys, man.
All right, Joe. Same here, my guy. thanks again to Antro Road, and thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of All Things Covered. If you like what you hear, make sure to follow and leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back soon where you can expect all things to be covered. Peace.
Peace.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.